from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Washington Post correspondent Tom Ricks may be the country's toughest, most plugged-in observer of the uniformed U.S. military, the privates and colonels and generals whose duty it is to carry out the policies of Pentagon and White House civilian leaders. Ricks won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on reform in the U.S. military. Now he's reporting on anger in the U.S. military, the anger of high-ranking officers at the path they have been put on in Iraq. Tonight on Point, an unvarnished view of dissent in the senior ranks on war strategy in Iraq. But first, we begin in Iraq, where the U.S. agreed to suspend offensive operations in the holy city of Najaf today after Iraqi Shiite leaders negotiated a deal with radical Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. U.S. forces and al-Sadr's militia both essentially agreed to stand down to end days of fighting. Thanasi Kambanes is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Baghdad just minutes after returning from Najaf. I asked him who won and who lost today in Najaf.
It's hard to tell on the streets of Najaf because even as the power brokers were sitting inside the holy shrine of Imam Ali hammering out the final details of this ceasefire or truce, there were thousands upon thousands of Mahdi militiamen parading in quite an impressive show of force right outside the shrine. They were ostensibly lining up to pay their respects to Muqtada al-Sadr, but it was quite clear they were also sending the message that there were legions of them, they were organized and still ready to fight. If Sadr is the loser, it's not yet clear, but it seems like his men are no less dedicated to him today for his offer to pull out than they were in the past months as they fought for him.
But it seems that U.S. forces are or are on the verge of retreating from Najaf or pulling out of Najaf. So what's happened here? Have they conceded to Muqtada al-Sadr essentially everything he wanted, or has he conceded what they needed?
If his forces leave the city, that'll essentially revert back to a status quo, because the setup in Najaf from the get-go, from last year during the war, was that U.S. soldiers did not enter the city. It's a very sensitive religious spot, and they respected the local clerics from the beginning. So if you went last fall, you wouldn't see American patrols in the city then either. The difference in the last month and a half was that Sadr's men took over the city and turned it into, for the first time, turned it into a combat zone. It was spared any fighting during the war last year. If Sadr's men withdraw, the U.S., I think, can claim victory, although it will be a bittersweet victory in that they had to lose a lot of credibility with the Shiite population that had been hitherto quite friendly to the U.S.
So combat would leave the streets of Najaf, but on the other side of the ledger, we see Muhammad al-Musawi quoted here, one of the senior Shiites who's been trying to arrange this peaceful end to the standoff. He is saying that the deal with al-Sadr includes transforming his militia into a political organization, not disbanding it, and delaying prosecution of al-Sadr until an elected government takes office next year, which may essentially mean dropping charges. There was a time when neither of these were put forward as options by the U.S. military.
Yeah, I think that's a case of reality catching up with policy. From the day that the United States military announced that they wanted to kill or capture Muqtada al-Sadr, which was a somewhat unfortunate choice of words given how his family is viewed by the public here, most Iraqi politicians as well as Arabists in the Coalition Provisional Authority said that the U.S. was going to have to back down from that demand, that ultimately no one on the political spectrum or the religious spectrum here would accept the idea of Sadr surrendering himself to an occupation government. I think the U.S. has backed down, and it could be a sort of ugly lesson in what happens when they try to go after absolute goals in a very amorphous political world.
So peace may return to the streets of Najaf. That would be a good thing. But where is this all heading, Thanasi, in military terms and political terms? Is the United States then getting closer to its goal of a stable Iraq, a democratic Iraq, or is it conceding power one way or another to people who oppose that goal?
I think looking farther ahead in the future, the question is, have the events of the last month and a half left Muqtada al-Sadr in a position to be the kind of militant power broker that could be an influence in Iraq, much like Hezbollah has been in Lebanon? And it's a little bit early to say yes to that, but I think that in the long term, the forces of moderation and stability have lost as a result of the last 2 months. And the settlement today, which essentially allows the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi army, to continue to exist in whatever form, meaning that they could quickly rearm, is bad news for the idea of a stable democratic Iraq.
Tanasi, after then Fallujah and now this settlement in Najaf, do we see a pattern here of the U.S. giving up on the notion of military victory exactly, reaching compromises, sending Iraqis in and pulling out?
Again, to go back to something we were talking about a minute ago, I'm not sure if it's them giving up on it or if it's the idea of them abandoning a new attempt to do this that began a few months ago. Much like what we're talking about in Najaf, they also stayed out of Fallujah for much of the winter and spring. So it seems to me that the United States made a sort of late-in-the-game effort to clean the slate and get rid of elements that it considered perhaps potential future enemies, and has realized that its original strategy was more productive, which was essentially of hoping that the enemies laid low and live and let live.
So if this is the new U.S. posture to go lower profile, not to engage so fiercely, to withdraw, to hunker down a bit, are U.S. forces still needed in Iraq?
I think they're certainly still needed in terms of policing the streets and keeping security. There is, in most of the country, no alternative security force. I think the question isn't, are they still needed? The question is, how much danger are they in, and how long, especially after June 30th, how long can U.S. troops continue to patrol in Iraq without provoking widespread rebellion? And I think the sign in the tea leaves that we're getting on that is that the people of Iraq are looking very forward to U.S. soldiers leaving the country.
But as of today, a much more accommodating U.S. position in Najaf, peace back on the streets there, and the big question remaining of where it goes with the U.S. military. Tanasi Kambanis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tanasi Kambanis is correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post, Tom Ricks, has covered conflict around the globe and knows the pulse of the U.S. military, from top-tier generals to enlisted soldiers. And here's his news. Dissent among senior officers over U.S. strategy in Iraq is not universal, but it is high and it is angry. Tonight, we're reaching beyond the Bush-Rumsfeld line on troop levels, deployment, and Iraq strategy for the perspective of the uniformed military. My guest is one of the country's most respected writers on military affairs, Tom Ricks, correspondent for The Washington Post. He was part of the Washington Post team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on 21st century challenges for the U.S. military. He coordinated the Post's coverage of last year's invasion of Iraq and was in the country last month reporting on the conflict now. Tom Ricks, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Tom, you have written powerfully in this month about the anger that has been building in the uniformed military, the Army in particular, about what's going on top level in Iraq. Some quite amazing quotes from Army Major General Charles Swanick, Jr., who was commander of the 82nd Airborne, spent much of the last year in western Iraq. You asked him if the U.S. is losing, he said, in Iraq. He said, "I think strategically we are." Army Colonel Paul Hughes, who directed strategic planning in Baghdad, "Unless we ensure that we have coherency in our policy, we will lose strategically." And right on down the line, you quote a senior general at the Pentagon saying, "It is doubtful we can go on much longer like this. The American people may not stand for it, and they should not." What is the source of this anger, which you quote someone saying, "People in the military are mad as hell"? What's the source of the anger, Tom Ricks?
There's a deep unhappiness among some officers, not all officers, but among some officers, with how this administration has handled going into Iraq. Increasingly, there's a feeling that the Army has been handed a mess, and through the sweat and blood of enlisted Army soldiers, is trying to make the best of it, but they're getting sick of it.
Does it matter in terms of how policy goes forward? Do these officers have influence over what policy is or will be?
I think they do. And when Army officers speak out in public on the record, that's a real shot across the bow of the administration. There's a feeling, I think, still in parts of the Bush administration that the media has vastly exaggerated the situation in Iraq, that it's much better than people think. And I think what some officers are trying to say is, no, actually, you need to start listening to the media. They actually are pretty fairly portraying what's happening out there in Iraq. Now, I want to emphasize, not all Army officers feel this. It's very common among Army officers in Iraq for them to say, why aren't you telling about all the good things we're doing? To which my answer to these guys is, it's nice you're painting orphanages, but tell me how that wins the war. They kind of pause and say, well, I don't know if it is, but I think it's a good thing. And I say, well, it's nice you guys are doing it. I'm glad it makes you feel good, but are we winning the war? And that's when some of them stop and say, I think I am in my little corner of Iraq, but I don't know about overall whether we are.
And beyond that, you quote high-level people essentially saying they fear that the thing is going to hell in a handbasket, powerfully quoting Colonel Hughes, saying, I lost my brother in Vietnam. I promised myself when I came on active duty, I would do everything in my power to prevent that sort of strategic loss from happening again. Here I am 30 years later thinking we will win every fight and lose the war because we don't understand the war we're in. This Colonel Paul Hughes as told to Tom Ricks of the Washington Post. But Tom, on the other side, we've got Air Force General Richard B. Myers, who is, of course, top dog, saying we're on the brink of success and telling it to Congress. How do you square these?
I can't really. I was struck as I sat and watched General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, testifying last week in front of Congress. I listened to him with a very optimistic portrayal of the situation in Iraq, and I talked to him afterwards. I said, that was kind of optimistic, and would you agree with that characterization? He said, yeah, it was optimistic. And I sat and listened, and I said, this just does not feel like a description of the country I was in last month for the month of April.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Iraq, I was struck at how much worse the situation was than the previous summer when I'd spent time there. I'd been back in January briefly, but the last time I'd really knocked around Iraq a lot was last July.
Yeah.
And when I got there, I was just dumbfounded at how much security had deteriorated. It did not feel like the same country to me. Every single place I was in Iraq in April, we were hit by mortar shells, except for one place, which is way out in the desert as a base picked because it was so remote, you couldn't mortar it. But I was out at Camp Victory, the U.S. military headquarters near Baghdad, and we heard mortar shells landing while I was interviewing General Abizay, the senior U.S. commander out there. I came back into town. It was dark because the interview had run late, and we came across what we thought, what we weren't sure, was an attempted kidnapping of us. The car was stopped across our path.
Mm.
And my driver, a former MiG pilot, did a three-point turn and got us out of there. And the hotel, a couple of days later, had a mortar shell land just outside the bureau. A week later, when I wasn't there, it was rocketed. It was pretty dicey in many parts of Iraq. I began to think maybe it's just for Westerners. As a Westerner, I didn't feel safe on the streets. I couldn't go to restaurants anymore, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then a poll came out that had been commissioned by the U.S. Occupation Authority, the CPA, and it found also that Baghdadis, the Iraqis themselves, had similar concerns about their own security, that it went from 50% in January saying that security had become a major issue for them to 75% at the beginning of last month, even before the upsurge in violence. So there are huge concerns there for average Iraqis about the occupation. I think the bottom line for Iraqis is they didn't like the occupation, they don't like the American presence, but they were willing to tolerate it if it provided security. But if the Americans can't provide security, the feeling is, what good are you?
I'm sure you heard President Bush at the Army War College on Monday night and his description of what's going on in Iraq. How does that square with what you saw, with what you're hearing from uniformed officers?
The Bush speech, I thought, was a good, straightforward summary of U.S. policy as it exists now. The problem with that is that there are very few people who know much about this who say that U.S. policy as it exists now is going well, is producing the desired effect. Putting aside my own thoughts and opinions, I was really struck by how many conservatives, people who had been hawkish on Iraq, were put off by the speech, were bothered by it. Columnists like Jim Hoagland of the Washington Post, George Will, a syndicated columnist, who are really beating the drum saying, this is not going right. We need to do something very different in Iraq, different from the course we're on. The course we're on is a course toward disaster. And it's fine for Bush to ignore what low-ranking officers or aging reporters might think. But when he is not listening to these strong conservative hawks, the people who supported him in going into the war so vigorously and advocated it, that kind of surprises me.
You quote a Pentagon consultant describing the administration's Iraq policy as dead man walking.
Yeah. I think at the Pentagon, the public face is still everything is just going wonderfully. But I think privately, there's a lot of thinking, man, you know, this has not gone well this year. We need to change course somehow.
We're talking with Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The Washington Post. He covers all things military. Recently back from Iraq, has covered the U.S. military in all its dimensions. with really extraordinary insight for years. Now he's focusing that on Iraq with us tonight on Iraq. We've taped this earlier today, so cannot take your calls, and I'm sorry for that. But we'll be right back with more of Tom Rex. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the situation in Iraq, the view of the uniformed U.S. military. Below Donald Rumsfeld, below Paul Wolfowitz, there's civilian administrators, overseers. What soldiers in uniform, with plenty of brass on their shoulders in many cases, are saying? We're talking tonight with Tom Rex. He's military correspondent for The Washington Post. Tom, you've laid out this sort of dead man walking view that, as you say, is big among a portion of officers, particularly in the U.S. Army. I want to look at some issues of how the current situation in Iraq might be addressed. One of the issues that comes up again and again is troop level. And I want to ask you to comment on a contrast that we saw in the last week between President Bush and General John Abizaid, head of U.S. Central Command. Let's listen first to what President Bush said about troops, the need for troops, what he would do about troops in Iraq in his speech Monday.
General Abizaid and other commanders in Iraq are constantly assessing the level of troops they need to fulfill the mission. If they need more troops, I will send them.
President Bush, if they need more troops, I will send them. Just a few days earlier, last Wednesday, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, here is General John Abizaid, head of U.S. Central Command.
There are certain types of troops that we don't have enough of. And we still don't have enough of them, and we got to figure out how to get them. And they're MPs, and they're MI guys, and they're HUMINT guys, and they're civil affairs people. And we must build a force structure that allows us to be able to fight a war like this in the 21st century, and they're not in the force structure.
Tom Rex, there it is. Help us sort through this. The president says they need more troops. I will send them. Top general says we need more troops. They are not in the force structure.
Abizaid is about as smart as a general as you're going to find. He's crackerjack smart. He knows his army extremely well. Interestingly, he also knows the Middle East well. He has a master's degree in Middle Eastern studies from Harvard, speaks Arabic, has spent time as a student living in Jordan. But on this issue of force structure, what Abizaid is saying publicly is you don't have certain types of troops that I want more of, military intelligence, military police, and so on. And he's also saying between the lines, the answer the Army's come up with isn't good. The Army's answer was fine. We'll take some other guys we're not using so much of, say, artillery troops, and we'll tell them, guess what, you're now MPs.
Or now the news we're seeing just today, Tom, even taking training troops from Louisiana and elsewhere that haven't been in service since the Vietnam era and throwing them into the breach.
Yeah. And when you start sending out your training troops, you're eating your seed corn. These are the guys who are supposed to prepare people for overseas deployments, not the people who are supposed to go themselves. When you take artillerymen and say, bam, you're now an MP, you wind up with some of the situations like we saw with the detainee abuse. If you're going to have people taking care of detainees in extremely stressful, difficult situations, and some of these detainees are genuinely really bad guys who will mess you up if they can, you want a lot of training, especially to take care of yourself, but also so you don't have to use violence except as the last step in running a prison. Abizaid is, I think, between the lines saying the solutions that the Army's come up with are creating problems for me, and that's why I'm sitting here in this hearing getting roasted by the Senate Armed Services Committee. The backstory behind that, Rumsfeld knows that Abizaid is not saying, also is there aren't a whole lot more troops on the shelf. When the president says, if they want more troops, I'll give them to you, the sad answer is there's only 10 divisions in the Army, on active duty in the Army, and every single division in the Army is either in Iraq and Afghanistan right now, getting ready to go, or coming home. There are no more troops. That's why they're taking the training troops from Fort Irwin, California, and Fort Polk, Louisiana.
And off the DMZ in Korea.
Yeah. Arguably the most dangerous spot in the world is Korea, and we're taking troops out of there because we need troops in Iraq. So the answer is you really can't kick up troop levels a whole lot higher than you have them now without substantially increasing the size of the Army. Now, there are other answers in Iraq. Some people have said, let's do it more like Afghanistan, where you have a few you know, 10,000 regular troops as your kind of guarantee force. Mm-hmm. But your real maneuver force, your striking arm that's out there every day, is a special ops force that's going out, special operations troops going after the bad guys, but not really trying to deal with the local population.
So the shift in strategy would be they're no longer patrolling streets. They're just hitting real hot spots?
Yeah, the theory there is that presence is not a good thing. Having a troop presence on the streets is not a good thing. It's a bad thing. It creates vulnerability, and it irritates the locals. So rather than put troops out there and get them shot, in Afghanistan, we don't have troops on the streets of Kabul hardly at all, the capital. You don't see American troops as you knock around Afghanistan. They're in a few special operations camps. They're in a few other camps, and they're focused on the bad guys. Now, what they call this is the whack-a-mole strategy. The mole pops up, and you whack them with the paddle. This is, and a lot of people have said, if you can't go to more troops in Iraq, go to fewer troops. Cut your troops down to 55,000. Cut your expenses way down. And maybe just focus on that kind of whack-a-mole strategy like you have in Afghanistan. But now, the downside to that is it says to Iraq, go your own way. And we're not quite sure we want Iraq to go its own way at this point, I think.
I want to talk about that, of course, because you've quoted lots of people on that theme. But let me ask first on the whack-a-mole strategy of Afghanistan. Will that work in a situation where you've got something like insurgency in the streets? We've seen it in Kabul, in parts of Baghdad, in Najaf just in the last few days. Can you whack a mole when what you've got is militias who are taking over little police stations here and there all over the place?
Well, you know the old chicken and the egg question, which came first? Here again in Iraq, you have the question, which came first, the U.S. presence or the militia? And the argument that some officers on the ground in Iraq have made is that our presence has created this opposition, that we've given them something to push against. And both in Fallujah and now in Najaf today, I think what you're kind of seeing is the U.S. commanders on the ground creating their own strategy because they don't see a national strategy of basically empowering the local militias, of going to this kind of whack-a-mole thing in which local power is turned over to locals who may not agree with us on anything, but fine, you guys run this part of the country. And we're kind of empowering the militias in Iraq in a way we long have in Afghanistan. We never picked a fight with Ismail Khan in Western Afghanistan. He doesn't agree with us on a lot of stuff, but it's fine. That's your turf. You run it. Don't get in our way.
But
and I think that's the implicit deal that we're now cutting in parts of Iraq. We may be simply recognizing the inevitable that you're going to have these local powers. It's going to be a very weak central government with local power. With militias running big parts of the country, guess what? That may be inevitable. It also is the strategy we settled on in Afghanistan and the strategy that the U.S. military kind of blindly, without national command authority, without the president or the secretary of defense running it, that they blindly seem to be groping toward as an outcome in Iraq.
Maybe the implicit policy. But as you quote senior people there, and we've talked just in the last week or two with Bill Kristol, for example, neoconservative at the Weekly Standard, hated the example of Fallujah, said big, big mistake. You quoted Wolfowitz just a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, Paul Wolfowitz, intellectual architect of the administration's vision of a free and democratic Iraq, the seed that would transform politics in the Middle East. He said to you, let's be clear, Fallujah has always been an outlier since the liberation of Baghdad. It's where the trouble began. It really isn't a model for anything for the rest of the country. Paul Wolfowitz.
This is one of those moments when being a reporter is like watching a thunderstorm on the horizon. You know there's a lot going on out there, a lot of energy being expended, but you're not quite sure what it is. I suspect there have been deep internal splits in the inside the Bush administration and also between the civilians and the military over exactly this outcome in Fallujah. It struck me that for that same article in which I quoted Secretary Wolfowitz, I also quoted General Abizaid. I asked General Abizaid whether we were winning strategically, and he said, well, I'm not going to go that far quite. He said, we're winning tactically, and there are good signs strategically. And I asked him what the good signs were. The first one he pointed toward was the outcome in Fallujah. In the same article, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, is saying Fallujah doesn't mean anything.
And it's not the model. He's saying now you're saying it may have been repeated today in Najaf.
So, yeah, here you have, I think, the U.S. military kind of saying, well, fellas, we tried it your way for a year. It didn't work. Now we're going to try it our way. Is this good for the country? No. We have a country where the civilians are supposed to run the military. But you have the military at this point saying, what you guys are giving us ain't working, and we need to figure some way out of this mess.
You quote a young Army general who, on the one hand, says he's incredibly angry. He says, I think they're going to break the Army with the current policy. But he also says that the U.S. should curtail its ambitions in Iraq. You quote him saying, "That strategic objective, a free, democratic, de-bathified Iraq, is grandiose and unattainable. It's just a matter of time before we revise downward and abandon these ridiculous objectives." Is that what's happening now? Is the revision downward of goals underway willy-nilly, whether or not Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz have signed off, Tom?
I think that may be exactly what's going on here. The big picture may be kind of lowering the goalpost here, kind of quietly walking away from this goal of saying Iraq is going to be a beacon of democracy that is going to transform the Middle East, which is official Bush administration policy. What I'm seeing is guys saying privately, you know, something far short of that, a stable Iraq that doesn't threaten its neighbors, that has some form of representative politics. Maybe it's representative of groups, not individuals. Mm. But something like that may be the way to go here. And I think, frankly, the Bush administration, if it could get this thing wrapped up by October, would be very, very happy.
Call it a victory along those lines. But even if that happens, your reporting indicates that U.S. troops might have to be there for a long time. You're talking about American troops fighting in Iraq for at least another 5 years and taking casualties all along the line, even if the mission is downsized.
There is a point at which, if you stay in Iraq long enough, winning and losing may not feel or look very different. Now, there is a downside to that, which is officers who talk about us being in Iraq for another 5 to 10 years, taking casualties all the time, may not realize we may be kicked out of Iraq well before then. Hmm. I don't see how anybody running for national political office in Iraq in the elections that are supposed to be held at the end of next January can run without advocating kicking out the Americans.
They've got to go.
Yeah. There's ways of hedging that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you could say, the day I take office as president of Iraq, I will sign a piece of paper telling the Americans to go. But then, you know, you negotiate, you leave over the next 18 months or next 2 years or something. But that'll be the extremely moderate position. The radical position will be the day I'm elected is the day the Americans are told they have to go.
Tom, how is that likely to be presaged in whatever comes out as the June 30th forward agreement of who controls military operations in Iraq? There's a debate over this right now in the Security Council of the UN, exactly how much strategic and operational control who will have. Where do you think that's going to come down? Does the United States have any room to negotiate that?
Well, here I side with the old Daryl Sanek saying, never make predictions, especially about the future. And we're also wandering away from my field of expertise, which is U.S. military operations, and into the extremely murky world of the future of Iraqi politics, of which I don't know enough to comment intelligently. But that said, I think the big worry is that you set up a government on June 30th that really is not able to carry the ball, that staggers and staggers and perhaps collapses before you get to elections.
Before to Iraq's elections in January of next year.
Of 2005, yeah.
Which throws it back in the lap of the U.S. military, does it not?
Well, as one officer bitterly said to me, we keep on talking about failed states. We're becoming an expert at it. We just created one.
Ouch. That hurts. General Sanchez, out. General Casey, 4-star general, number 2 in the U.S. Military or the Army. In. Why?
I think it's been an unfortunate situation for General Ricardo Sanchez, the Army Lieutenant General who's the ground commander in Iraq. I want to say, before I forget this, Sanchez is a very decent man. I was embedded with his staff in May of 2003 when he still commanded the 1st Armored Division. Treated me very decently. A stand-up guy, a very solid Army soldier.
You're pointing this out because, of course, he's come in the mud splash from Abu Ghraib pretty heavily.
Yes, and now it looks like he's going to be leaving his position there under a cloud in a month or two, moved on to somewhere else, maybe even retired out of the Army. And people will remember him for this last few months in this prison detainee abuse scandal. Now, everybody knows who follows this stuff that there's been talk of moving General Sanchez out for several months. I think I reported it somewhat prematurely last October that they were contemplating it. Mm-hmm. So he will move out. It's unfortunate. The guy is a real American success story. He comes out of a brutally poor family in the Rio Grande Valley along the Mexico-Texas border.
Yeah.
I think the first guy ever in his family to get a college education, rises to become a general in the U.S. military. A real American story. And for it to end under this cloud, I think is quite sad. Now, what they're doing is they're going to move him out. It's not clear where they're going to move him. They talked at one point of moving him to head of Southern Command, which is the U.S. military headquarters for operations in South America. Mm-hmm. But there's talk that he's unconfirmable for that because that's a position that you have to have confirmation for by the Congress.
And he took a lot of grief before the Congress on the supervision.
And the Bush administration doesn't want to have a whole lot more congressional inquiries and testimony about all this. They're tired of it. They want to move on. So it'd be a shame to see General Sanchez get ousted, sort of just tossed in the trash pile for that. He's being replaced by General George Casey, it looks like, although there's still some maneuvering at the Pentagon, and Donald Rumsfeld holds his cards very close to his chest on this sort of thing. There's also talk of Rumsfeld's chief military assistant, General Vance Craddock, getting some sort of senior position, and they're still sorting that out, I think.
Rumsfeld's number one right arm military guy being in charge of operations, these operations in Iraq?
Well, at first I think they were going to go for him, but he has he's three stars. He's a lieutenant general. So again, that would be a position if they wanted to give him four stars, that would require confirmation. And so that's why they seem to have turned the spotlight instead onto General Casey, who's a four-star officer. He's the number two guy in the U.S. Army.
Is this an indication that policy's changing, or is it simply a sense that, however tragic it may seem to some, General Sanchez has to go?
I don't know. I wouldn't read policy change through personnel changes that much. When this administration changes its policy, I would look for actions. And I think Fallujah and Najaf actually may be the real significant policy changes, even though they don't want to say so publicly and even though there seems to be a lot of disagreement behind closed doors about this. But I do think that with a kind of inevitability to it, even though it's not being stated, through their actions on the ground, policy does seem to be changing in Iraq as they kind of lower the goalpost, move towards more modest goals. And I think actually instead of trying to fight the flow in Iraq, the flow of power, you know that old song, Don't Fight the Feeling?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of picking fights with everybody, with the Sunnis, with the Shiites, with the Kurds, I think they are moving towards, hey, let's just let these guys run each part of their country, cross our fingers and hope there's not a civil war or a regional war that results from this.
Is this a direction adrift that's likely to pacify some of that profound anger, as you describe it, that you've written about within Army ranks?
If it gets the Army out of this without too much more damage, I think it would. At the same time, the Army anger over this runs very deep. It runs back to before the beginning of the war when they felt that General Eric Shinseki, who was then the chief of staff of the Army, mm-hmm. wasn't listened to when he warned first privately and then publicly that he thought several hundred thousand troops would be required for the occupation and pacification of Iraq. So they feel for a long time that the Army's been kind of set up here and handed a really bad situation and that they don't get the attention of the military, of the civilian leadership when they bring this up.
But events on the ground may be getting them attention now. Tom Ricks, please stand by. We're talking tonight with Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. He's been writing insightfully for the last month about the uproar in Washington over policy in Iraq. The month before that, he spent in Iraq. We taped this interview earlier today, so can't take your calls. I'm sorry for that, but there's much more to come. We'll be right back with it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. Not long back from Iraq and in the thick of all that's going on in Washington over policy toward Baghdad, toward Iraq. Tom Ricks, General Anthony Zinni spoke out last weekend on 60 Minutes. He's got a new book out, extremely critical of the war effort. What did you make of Zinni's critique?
Zinni is really well-liked within the U.S. military because he's very bright but also talks in a kind of straightforward working-class Philadelphian way. I once described him in print as a knuckle-dragging intellectual.
I suppose in the military that endeared you to him.
Well, it's funny. He called me up and he said, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, in the Marines, it's supposed to be a compliment. You know, he's both a weightlifter and a book reader.
Right. Terrific.
He once told me that he keep three books on his bedside, one a heavy book if he's not tired, one a lighter book of sort of biography if he's tired, and one just like detective fiction if he's exhausted. But he's made a point of reading a book a week his entire life, even when he was in combat in Vietnam.
Wow. And he says heads must roll at the very top in the Defense Department.
Yeah, the thing that surprised me about this is Zinni's been saying this since before the war began. The amazing thing about this war is, by my count, every single guy who has commanded out there as the head of the Central Command, Abizade's predecessors, every single one of them who was public opposed the war. Schwarzkopf, General Hoar, another Marine, General Zinni. There was one other, Army General Binny P, who has not said anything either privately or publicly as far as I know. But you had three major commanders from Central Command all saying this is nuts. So Zinni's been saying this for a couple of years. I think the difference is the people are starting to listen to him. He used to be a kind of voice in the wilderness on this. Schwarzkopf popped up and then kind of disappeared on the subject. Zinni's been out there beating the drum for a couple of years, but I think finally people are saying, you know, this Zinni guy is starting to make sense. And people are listening to him, and I think that's why that resonated. His critique is not really very different than it's been for the last couple of years. His basic critique is, look, the policy that I was running out there under President Clinton was containment of Iraq, and it was working. That was a very common view among senior officers in the U.S. military. It's still a common view, which is, look, Saddam was aging. His military was falling apart after 10 years of sanctions. We had him under the umbrella of two no-fly zones. He was really contained. And the only outcome you were heading towards was a more aging Saddam Hussein, who was becoming weaker. As one very senior guy said to me, what do you want in Iraq? You want a secular, not a radical Muslim, but a secular leader who is not going to threaten his neighbors, who is more gentle than Saddam Hussein. And every day the containment works, we move towards that goal with an aging, tired Saddam. Now, the opposite of that argument that General Zinni doesn't answer or didn't address, at least in his critique, is yes, but Saddam had two vicious, almost crazy sons, either one of whom could have inherited power and kept that regime rolling for another 30 or 40 years, like the situation you have in North Korea now.
Those two sons now dead, so that's out of the picture, but it was a fly in the ointment of the just contain them view.
Yeah, containment. And the people like Wolfowitz have come back and said, is it moral to face the prospect of another 30 or 40 years of this terrible regime that really treats its own people brutally, putting up with that and having that sort of cancer in the middle of the Middle East? And Zinni's answer has been, well, yeah, we kept him in the box. It wasn't good for Iraqis. Maybe eventually he would have toppled or would have been a coup. You don't know how it would have come out. But it's a lot better than the alternative, which is at this point we now have over 5,000 Americans in Iraq, dead or wounded, and we're spending money at a $4 billion a month burn rate there. $1 billion a week of U.S. taxpayers' money is going to Iraq with not a whole lot to show for it so far.
Tom, this was the argument, as you say, even before the curtain came up on the war. So where do the two sides stand at this point? Has the Zinni view gained credence? In some dimensions, this is the political question for all American voters this fall. But to the extent that this gets hashed out between the uniformed military and the civilian brass and the neoconservative perspective that kind of rushed in here, has that been discredited now? Is it still in the saddle? How does it intersect with the revolution in military affairs, military reform that was underway even before the neocons came on the scene?
Who knows? I mean, Shakespearean tragedies come in five acts, and I think we're only in act three. This is not the climax of this story. We have a long way to go before we see how this plays out. The difference now, I think, is that people like Zinni are enjoying much more credibility than they had a couple of years ago because their warnings, many of their warnings, have been borne out. The people like the neoconservative ilk have less credibility because the two basic pillars on which they argued for invading Iraq have both come into deep questioning. The two pillars being the existence of weapons of mass destruction, WMD, no stockpiles have been found. And the other argument was that there was a clear nexus between Saddam Hussein's regime and terrorism. And there, no clear nexus has been established. So the two pillars on which the invasion was built have both come into real questioning. The third one, which they've argued more for recently, was the humanitarian grounds that Paul Wolfowitz especially tends to emphasize. And unfortunately, while I think that is still true, that it was a good thing to get rid of Saddam Hussein, that has been tainted or tarred by the detainee abuse scandal.
Tom, many calls in recent weeks, especially since that scandal at Abu Ghraib and perhaps beyond, we're seeing reports now, for heads to roll. General Zinni is not the only one. Democrats, some Republicans even sort of raising the issue. Al Gore howling about it yesterday, calling out in New York for Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Cambone, all to be booted. Do you see any of these people resigning, being fired, being dropped in or around election time, or if there's a second Bush term in that term?
This administration does not like to admit mistakes. I mean, if there's one really striking theme through the administration, it's they kind of keep their head down and bulldog on 3 yards in a cloud of dust and not going to admit to making mistakes. The other major sort of characters of the administration is how close hold they have on information, which kind of goes with that. Mm-hmm. That said, when they change course, they do so precipitously. I remember back when they threw Paul O'Neill as Treasury Secretary overboard and threw Larry Lindsley, the economic advisor, overboard with him.
Right.
The two guys really didn't have much to do with each other, but they wanted to make it clear that they were changing policy.
Clean
sweep. They kind of threw them overboard one day. Mm-hmm. So I think if they did decide that Rumsfeld was going to go, I think you would see that sort of clean sweep of Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and so on, partly because they wouldn't have to put Wolfowitz up for a confirmation hearing and effectively have a congressional referendum on the handling of Iraq. So I think they probably would go for a different change in course, you know, whether it was Sam Nunn or Senator Hagel, for a different sort of Secretary of Defense, a more traditional realpolitik type of guy, instead of a guy like Wolfowitz, who's much more of a sort of idealistic visionary.
Or Rumsfeld, but you're talking there about a second term, should that come.
Or even in the next few months, if they decided, I mean, this administration does want to get reelected, and if they decided that in order to get reelected, that Donald Rumsfeld had to go, I think they would send him on his way. I don't see that happening yet, though.
Tom, we've just got a minute left. Abu Ghraib and the prisoner abuse, torture, call it what you will. How deep a stain, how long-lived a problem for the U.S. military globally?
It is a very big problem for the U.S. military, one of the biggest I've ever seen. Anybody who disagrees with that owes it to themselves to go online and find General Taguba's 15-6 report. My jaw dropped when I read the general's report on that prison. In all the years I've covered the U.S. military, I have never seen such a dumbass unit. It is just, it makes you weep to read that report. They are a horrible military unit. I have never seen anything like this in the U.S. Army. It's a real problem. I don't think it's a few bad apples because it resulted from several bad decisions as well. Whether commanders wittingly knew what was going on, commanders did not lead that unit. That unit was not trained, and that needs to change.
A problem in a long-lived one, as you describe it. Tom Ricks, we thank you for your extraordinary reporting. Keep it up, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, filmmaker Ken Burns calls for unity between red and blue America. This is On Point. The latest USA Today CNN Gallup poll shows President Bush and Senator John Kerry in a statistical dead heat for the third straight week. The poll appears to confirm again the deep, even split of what's been tagged red and blue America. As he surveys the red and blue, acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns is reminded of the Civil War, which he documented in one of his most notable films. Speaking earlier this week at Yale University's Class Day exercises, Ken Burns told the class of 2004 to look back at the Civil War to remember, quote, why we Americans agree to cohere, why unlike any other country on earth, we are still stitched together by words, and most important, their dangerous progeny, ideas. Throughout this month, On Point is bringing you excerpts of notable graduation speeches from around the country. Here is Ken Burns speaking earlier this week in New Haven, Connecticut.
It is easy, I am sure, during these times of international upheaval and titanic change everywhere, to like an ostrich retreat inward, to retire to our spiritually as well as physically gated communities, to smugly convince ourselves that we in this country have somehow triumphantly made it through, that our destiny as a people, a society, a nation is now assured, that like some perpetual motion machine, that we will go on forever. Nothing could be more dangerous than this arrogant belief, brought on and amplified as it is by an almost complete lack of historical awareness among us, and further reinforced by a modern media cloaked in democratic slogans but dedicated to the most stultifying kind of consumer existence, convincing us to worship gods of commerce and money and selfish advancement above all else. There are grave doubts at the hugeness of the land, Henry Adams once wrote, and whether one government can comprehend the whole. It is a perfect quote, accurately conveying the anxiety of Americans in the middle of the 19th century who feared that this collection of former colonies could ever expand to continental status, could ever deal as one nation with the sectional discord that now threatens civil war, could, as Adams put it so well, comprehend the whole. Civil war did come, yet the phrase the United States are, as we referred to ourselves plurally before the war, paradoxically morphed after the war into a singular the United States is that we still ungrammatically refer to today. But alas, today we find ourselves in the midst of a new, subtler, perhaps more dangerous civil war. The first one proved above all that a minority view could not secede politically or geographically from this union. Now we are posed to fight that war again and perhaps again and again, this time culturally, where the threat is fundamentalism wherever it raises its intolerant head. The casualties this time will be our sense of common heritage, our sense of humor, our sense of balance and cohesion. The ultimate stakes, though, are just as great as those Abraham Lincoln faced. The Union and the very survival of our country. What we are seeing now is a succession of ideas and identification from the mainstream. In the name of the truth, we have created an infinite number of different truths, all pulling in different directions, all oblivious to the old or even a new conception of the whole. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum. Our first civil war started, as the writer Shelby Foote suggested, because we failed to do what we Americans do best, compromise. We like to think of ourselves as uncompromising people, he said, but our genius is for compromise. And when that broke down, we started killing each other. The lesson for us today is tolerance and the mitigating wisdom that sees beyond the dialectical preoccupation that has set each individual, each group, each region of the country against the whole. So I ask those of you graduating tomorrow, male or female, black or white, brown or yellow, young or old, straight or gay, to become soldiers in a new Union Army, an army dedicated to the preservation of this country's greatest ideals, a vanguard against this new separatism and disunion, a vanguard against those who, in the name of our great democracy, have managed to diminish it. This is a family problem, our problem, and it's not a red state or a blue state problem. It is our problem.
Filmmaker Ken Burns delivering Yale University's Class Day speech earlier this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.